This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of September 14th, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 413. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest, I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker, and on the Big Deal feature, hear the climax of the Vancouver Anti-Corruption Institute's June conference on asset forfeiture. International experts joined forces to share notes on how to take away cars, cash, and real estate from criminals. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. In June, the Breaker.News covered the Vancouver Anti-Corruption Institute's two-day conference on asset forfeiture. Legal experts from Canada, the US, UK, and Ireland gathered to discuss ways and means of fighting crime by taking away organized crime's ill-gotten gains, such as real estate and cars bought with dirty money. The conference ended June 18th with a wrap-up session hosted by Peter German, the chair of the Vancouver Anti-Corruption Institute's advisory committee. Peter German is also the former head of the RCMP in Western and Northern Canada and the former head of Correctional Service of Canada in the Pacific region.
Now, with this final panel, is bring up a few of our key speakers from the last day or so and really ask them what their takeaway is from what we've heard and, where to from here. And I think the theme that sort of has been bubbling is forfeiture at a crossroads, whether it's civil, criminal forfeiture. We do know that in this country, as we've discussed and various people have mentioned, you have civil forfeiture, you have criminal. It works in some places, it doesn't work in others, civil here, criminal, and so forth. And then, as with our last panel, a lot of information sharing issues. So there's a whole lot of things going on in this space, but we've also heard from, our international speakers that everybody also, it seems, deals with criminal, civil, and administrative forfeiture, but some deal with it differently than we do, and there may be some lessons learned. So without further ado, I'm going to ask Melinda. Melinda, what's your takeaway? And take as long as you want.
This is Melinda Murray, the Executive Director of Criminal Property Forfeiture for the Government of Manitoba.
Is this working? Yes. I guess my takeaway, and I think I really liked the last panel's comment that information is oil. And it seems like there are too many silos, there's too many roadblocks to us doing our jobs. I have 100% agree with the rule of law. I'm a lawyer by trade. I agree with due process. I have no issue with any of those. But I think there are better, more efficient ways of doing that without everyone being unable to share. So I really found the CAB presentation from Ireland to be very telling, that you can get everyone under the same roof and working together towards a common goal. Because I think at the end of the day, everyone in this room has the same goal. And it's problematic to me that we have all of these roadblocks and these, I believe in the rule of law, I believe in due process, and I believe in privacy rights. But how is it that in Ireland, you can have the revenue people housed and embedded with the asset forfeiture and law enforcement? And I don't think their population has lost faith and trust in their organization. So I don't think people are, because they're now housed together, that somehow no one is now filing taxes as they should and as they're supposed to. So I wonder about some of the what we've been told for 20, 30, 40 years, and maybe we need to start breaking those down and looking at things differently, because criminals are working in a different fashion. The world is different. We need to take a closer look at how we're dealing with all of this. From the civil forfeiture perspective, and I won't take up much time, but the civil forfeiture perspective, it was, as Phil Tautel has mentioned, it was a great win for us just to get access to FinTrack disclosures. That was huge, and that was years in the making. But we have other things on our list that we are looking for disclosure. And I can give you an example. I don't think we mentioned it at our last, at our panel, but we have a bank act that's so antiquated, it really needs to be revamped. We've got, you know, for example, if, and this is the example we always use, Phil has used it many times as well. If a criminal opens up a bank account in Newfoundland and then moves to BC and does all his drug trafficking in BC, BC civil forfeiture can't access that bank account because technically its location is where it was first opened up in Newfoundland, which is ridiculous because nowadays with digital access to everything, it doesn't make sense. So if that criminal is now doing drug trafficking in BC, but he opened up his account in a province that doesn't have civil forfeiture, that's a gap, that's a problem for us, and we need to rectify that. There's, you know, we'll say very honestly, we have felt that reform, legislative and policy reform needs to take place with respect to the CRA Act, the Canada Revenue Act. I think there needs to be recognition that civil forfeiture is a legitimate player that has a role to play in this space dealing with asset forfeiture, and we should be viewed similarly to law enforcement. That is key. But we were always, as Phil Tautel, I'm using one of his analogies, we were always like the child at the kids' table, never invited to the adult table. Now we're, you know, between the Cullen Commission inquiry that essentially said you need civil forfeiture, and FATF, which says you need civil forfeiture or non-conviction-based forfeiture, we need to start looking at what we're doing in this space as legitimate work that has a role to play, not taking away from criminal forfeiture or getting in the way or jeopardizing criminal proceedings. But we all have a space and a place to work, and we need to recognize that. So I think breaking down silos, and it's sad to me that Peter's talking about something from 30 years ago, and we still seem to be in a similar situation 30 years later. It's this bureaucratic, slow to change process, which I think actually frustrates a lot of people. And I think that's problematic because you're gonna lose the best people for the job if there are so many roadblocks that you're just trying to navigate all of this bureaucracy and red tape. So, you know, I'm hoping to see that kind of legislative and policy change. And working together and embedding, like that CAB model is just unbelievable to me, and it looks like it's working very well. So that's my takeaway, is we still have to plug away and work very hard at opening up more opportunities and getting ahead of the criminals, not trying to run after them.
Jeffrey Simser is the former Director of Civil Forfeiture for Ontario's Ministry of the Attorney General.
Right. So I'll be brief too. One of the jurisdictions that's not here is Ontario, biggest province in the country. They were invited. I can tell you they were invited, and they said no, they weren't allowed to come. And the civil forfeiture program in Ontario might gently be described as a complete tire fire. It's a disaster out there. And I created it, so this is my soapbox. It saddens me. It absolutely saddens me because we used to be best in class. And when BC and Manitoba, when they were starting, I was the one that went out and mentored and worked with people, and they're off the radar. And I don't know why. Like a really, other than the Attorney General giving a free pass to organized crime, I don't know why. Anyway, that's my soapbox. In terms of my takeaway from the conference, I reflect a little bit on what Kevin Brousseau said. So anyone that was living in the GTA 6, 12, 18 months ago, there was a massive auto theft problem. And Kevin sort of averted to it. And it got to the point where if you had a high-end car like a Land Rover or whatever, people were putting bollards in their driveway, you know, these movable little things, because the security system on the car, they could fit, the bad guys figured out how to sort of fake the key fob, and then these teenagers going in, and they were stealing these $90,000 cars, $100,000 cars. There were stories of people that put little Apple AirTag in the car, and then they, oh my God, it's in Nigeria, or it's on a shipping container in Montreal Harbor, or whatever. And what Kevin said about this, I think, is quite telling, because he said, look, we weren't going to arrest our way out of that problem by getting the teenagers. That was never going to do anything. He said, when we all got together in law enforcement and started working up the food chain to get to the operating mines, to get to the guys that were really making the money, it started to have an impact. And you don't see the stories now that you would have seen 12 months ago or whatever. You don't see bollards being put into driveways in the same way. And so for me, asset forfeiture is a really important part of that narrative. And it's not the only one, and it may not always be the primary one. There are lots of times we have a bad guy and he should just go to jail. Like that, end of, no question, he should be prosecuted and go to jail. But they care about their money. I've been in the room with bikers, I've taken a lot of bikers on, and you know, they will look you in the eye and say, I'll stand on a dime, I'll serve 10 years. And then you start talking about the girlfriend's condo, and all of a sudden, the body language, everything changes, because that's what they really do care about. And that really affects what they do. It creates friction and difficulty for them. So I'm really hopeful after these 2 days. We've heard lots of great ideas. There's lots of things we can improve on. But other than maybe our American friends, that's a little depressing. But that's a three-year problem. But I'm really hopeful about what's possible in Canada coming. On that note,
Stephen Casella, the former deputy chief of the U.S. Department of Justice's Asset Forfeiture and Money Laundering Section. Stephen Casella is also the former chief of the Asset Forfeiture and Money Laundering Section in the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Well, thank you, Jeff. I have two observations, one about forfeiture, one sort of a broader comment. First, I have been enormously impressed with the commitment in this room and with all of my colleagues in Canada to bringing forfeiture forward as an important law enforcement tool. It is absolutely essential. It's not the only tool we have, and it's not the solution to all of our problems, but it's an enormously important part in order to preserve the rule of law, in order to deter future crime, in order to get money back to victims, and for all the other reasons that we do forfeiture. There's a serious commitment here, which is wonderful to see, and on a very important aspect of the criminal justice system. Even more so as we understand that we've been in a global economy now for decades, and in a global economy, money moves across international borders, and we've been saying since the first time I met my friend Barry 25 years ago at Cambridge that we needed to work together because the money moves across the borders and we have to be able to internationalize our law enforcement powers. And one way to do that, of course, is to make sure we all have the same laws so that we can be working together. And with the FATF's recognition of the importance of civil forfeiture, that's another step forward. We have to be able to enforce each other's orders. We have to be able to have similar enough systems so that we understand that we're speaking the same language when we go after assets. And that's never been more important than it is now with respect to the advent of cryptocurrency, because we don't even know where the cryptocurrency is. In fact, it's an unanswerable question as to where is the cryptocurrency, right? All of these cases are international, and you have to be doing the cases more often than not civilly, because you don't know where the bad guy is. You might not even know who the bad guy is, and even if you knew who he was and where he was, you're not going to get him back if he's in North Korea or Russia or someplace like that. And so we have to use civil forfeiture. And that's been recognized here. I mean, you've pointed out the problem in Ontario, but obviously we have people here in certain provinces in Canada that are moving forward. And myself, my two colleagues who are here with me today, we're more than happy to work with you. If any problem you encounter in the civil forfeiture or criminal forfeiture space in terms of interpretation of what the law means is probably a problem we had already in the United States, and we probably already have a, you know, a stack of case law that would be that would help inform you as to how that might have been resolved. And we're more than happy to share that with you and our expertise with respect to the seizure and forfeiture of cryptocurrencies. More than happy to share all of that and to help spread the word to those provinces that don't yet have the tool. We'd be happy to work with you to do that as well. So that's my comment with respect to forfeiture. I'm pleased to see the recognition of its importance and happy to work with you. Anything that we can contribute would be our pleasure. The broader point is I think that we've all recognized that there is an incredibly unnecessary and unreasonable tension between the United States and Canada. What sense in the world does it make to pick a fight with your best friend on the other side of the world's largest undefended international border? Makes no sense whatsoever. And anything we can do to sort of counteract the bad feeling that's developed, we're happy to do. And also to push back. So we have to be able to push back on the challenges to the rule of law. I mean, the fact that we're no longer seeing enforcement of corruption statutes in the United States. We're no longer going after the proceeds of corruption that are invested in the United States is to me a tragedy. And we have to be able to push back on that. We have to be able to challenge authority and do whatever we can to make sure that this is a passing phase that can be rectified in the future. Everyone has to find a way to push back and challenge authority. I'm going to make this point, Jeff, and I think you know where I'm going. 2 weeks ago, a young reporter asked the President of the United States in the Oval Office what his reaction was to the term taco, that Trump always chickens out when it comes to tariffs. Well, that reporter was my daughter. So that's where I'm coming from. So thank you all for inviting me here. I've really appreciated the opportunity.
Phil Tautel is the executive director of the Civil Forfeiture Office in the Government of British Columbia.
Thanks. So I can only speak for BC. We have a saying here that when you come to the west side of the Rockies, everything's different. The air is better. And it's not just because we burn the best cannabis. It's because the air is honestly better. And the truth is, you saw the Solicitor General. BC government has been behind this program for 20 years. So it has never stopped being behind this program, even though we've had our hiccups here and there. The RCMP and Adam and his shop and the Asset Forfeiture Unit has been behind this program for 20 years. It has never stopped. Law enforcement has been behind us all the way. We have the best lawyers from the Attorney General, some of which are here, some of which in private industry. We're firing on all cylinders. Things are wonderful. And yet the one thing we just can't figure out is once you get on the other side of the Rockies, we can't figure out our federal brothers for the life of me. We used to call it in the RCMP, Ottawa is the center of excellence. And it wasn't said, you know, it was a little bit of sarcasm thrown in there. And we just couldn't figure it out. Because the people I get to work with on the federal side, my RCMP colleagues, PPSC colleagues, CBSA colleagues, to a person, they're excellent. The system's not working. The machinery isn't designed right. And surely we have the smartest people in this room on this panel, all the people that couldn't make it here. Surely we can untangle this nest and redo the machinery, because it's certainly not the people. So I'm hoping 2025 with FATF coming, 2025 with maybe I'll be spending $175 for a bottle of bourbon as opposed to my standard 50. And if we can't figure out this tariff thing, but hopefully, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. We use this year, as Peter said earlier, as an inflection point to take a different trajectory and move in a really positive way. And as good as CAB is, we surpass it. So that's just my comments.
Barry Ryder is a professor at Cambridge University, and he is also the chair of the Cambridge International Symposium on Economic Crime.
Thank you. Well, I agree with everything that's been said. There's just really two points that I'd like to make, and that is I've been tremendously impressed by the way you do things in Canada, and particularly the extent to which you focus on assets, and the level of political and governmental support you get. And I think that's the crucial thing. And one of the, I think, sensitive aspects to this is how politicians, the media, society evaluates what you're doing. And I think that depends so much on what the objectives are. Now, when you look at the Cabin Island, I think it's extremely important to realize, as I think Barry made the point, that that initiative really grew out, not just of those two cases, but as an imperative in national security. And that is still, and I can say this because I was actually in Dublin a little while ago with the minister, they see it still as an issue in national security. Also, they wanted to try and get the EU's new international, or European-wide, asset recovery agency based in Dublin. I don't think that's worked, but it has a very, very high political imperative. Now, whereas in the United Kingdom, for example, when we had our assets recovery agency, that was judged by society and politically on how much money it actually recovered, which was peanuts. So it was wound up. And, OK, we do have, obviously, civil asset recovery, but that is in the National Crime Agency. And there are mixed views in the UK as to how effective the civil aspect is. I mean, a report that was published by the Cabinet Office described the results as pathetic because it was looking at the amounts. Now, we're very good in the UK on basically seizing what's there on arrest. Right? And we do that through our criminal system. But there are some, it very much depends on what you expect the relevant law, the relevant agency to be actually doing and how you measure that. Now, I mean, another point I think that's important internationally, and I think, you know, as has been underlined, that most of these cases, certainly the cases involving large sums of money, are almost by definition going to be cross-border international. And of course, there are countries that don't have the relevant law or know that they're not going to get cooperation politically. Now, I used to do quite a bit of advisory work for the Prosecutor General of China. Now, China knows it's not going to get any cooperation from anyone. Right? So how can it actually pursue all these fugitives? Well, hence my comments. It seems like as though it was a week ago, but it was only the day yesterday, wasn't it? About the use of the civil law. One of the advantages of using the civil law, and I'm not talking about civil asset recovery, I'm talking about using the ordinary civil law, is that the politics don't matter. The only thing that matters is you've got the money to hire the lawyers. And that is true of enforcement and so on and so forth. There's a lot of countries out there that don't have the sophistication, don't have the resources. And I think, you know, that's another point that I think was thrown up. Most people spoke about resources. And I think Adam made an extremely important point when he said the police can't deal with everything. And there is an inevitable set of priorities in policing. Which, of course, and as I've said, you know, in the UK, we do not have not taken economic crime or crime in the economic area particularly seriously. I think that's changing to a certain extent. But what we don't have the resources. We don't have the expertise. As soon as the NCA hire someone as a financial investigator, they work there for a few months and then go off and increase their, or certainly double, triple, quadruple their salary, going off to be a compliance officer in one of the banks. So we're continuously creaming off the expertise which does exist in the public sector. And an area that perhaps, certainly in the UK, because I think most of us in the UK now would see our asset-related law, not in terms of recovery, not in terms of restitution, but as a tool for disruption. And that has an even greater political problem because the more effective you are at disruption, the less there's anything to see, which causes a political problem in terms of budget, in terms of relevance, and so on and so forth. Also, and I just throw this out, there is a real rule of law aspect when your primary structure and your primary strategy of interdiction has nothing to do with the ordinary criminal justice system. In terms of accountability, in terms of success, in terms of how you operate. So, you know, disruption is critical. I mean, it's our, you know, I mean, certainly in the UK, that would be our primary strategy. To what, how it really works, to the extent to which it's successful, I think, you know, is a debatable issue. One final point, and that is where you do get these recoveries, particularly internationally, and we've had a case recently in the UK where a lady from China, a lawyer, who was working in a takeaway, actually went and bought for cash a house in one of the most expensive areas of London. When she was arrested, the police found on a laptop under her bed 3.9 billion pounds worth of Bitcoin. Now that's been seized. Now it seems, and that's one of the very few examples really where Bitcoins have been successfully seized, but that is, it is thought that she was a courier for a very significant fraud that took place in Shanghai about 2.5 years ago. And the money, and obviously Bitcoin values have gone up, the money that may have been involved in that is nearer to 50 billion, right? So, you know, there's some very real issues there. The Chinese are very upset because they supplied a lot of the information which led to the further investigations on this. They're very upset that it's been seized and gone to the UK Treasury. So, you know, there's lots and lots of issues out there in terms of international cooperation to think about. I'm not going to say any more other than to say this was an absolutely tremendous conference, and congratulations to you all, and you're far ahead of us.
Well, I want to give everybody out here an opportunity. Thank you so much to the panel. Comments, questions, your takeaway, or questions to the panel, your takeaway, any thoughts? Oh, Adam, right over there.
Thank you. A couple comments, and first off, yeah, it's been excellent. Always learn something. I want to just say, so last year when I had the pleasure of going to Cambridge and participating in the symposium, what it really did for me was take this, Canada sucks, BC sucks, we can't do anything right here, to realize the world sucks, they can't do anything right, and it's everywhere. But what was interesting is you, Professor, in your comment that you just made is your recognition of the support that's occurring here with government when each and every day we're frustrated with government and the lack of support. And so it's all about perspective, which is kind of an interesting thing to take on. And to reiterate the issue about, you know, this is not just a police issue that was alluded to. This is an everything issue. We all need to cooperate. But what I'd like to do is put back to you the question about, right now it feels like internationally we're kind of disintegrating in our levels of cooperation at a time when we need to be doing the opposite. As it relates to corruption, as it relates to the flow of money, the need to collaborate with like-minded legislation. So I'm just curious, what's the solution? And I'm not asking for one. I don't think that's a possibility for you to come up with one. But really more just the thought process around how we're going to start to address that. And going back to what you said, Stefan, about our relationship with our American partners. And it's just kind of that, like, it's very disheartening, I think, for everyone, regardless of who you are, whether you're in law enforcement or not. And I just want to say thank you for the comments, but also what your thoughts might be around that.
Oh, me.
Unless you want to go.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more, but I mean, the world is fractured, isn't it? I mean, if you just look at the geopolitics today, I think it's perhaps not surprising that there are these quite profound issues. I mean, I've always wondered the extent to which there's always been an obviously close working relationship between Canada and the United States and Britain and so forth. But the perception, if you were a Nigerian police officer or a Malaysian police officer, or certainly if you were a Chinese prosecutor, would be totally different. There is no cooperation out there. And I think, you know, as William Browder's comments this morning about Interpol, where he said, well, Interpol was a club between states. I mean, I'd agree with him. There's many problems with Interpol, and I was Commonwealth Observer to Interpol for 10 years. But he actually got that wrong. Interpol, constitutionally, is a club of police forces. And that's why there is not the political momentum on a lot of these issues in terms of international cooperation. Also, I think that certainly Brexit has not helped the UK in terms of international cooperation. We don't have the access that we used to European systems. So that is an example there. And obviously with the conflicts one sees really right throughout the world. I mean, a friend of mine is a very senior police officer in India. Well, he gets absolutely no cooperation from Pakistan and Bangladesh in these circumstances. So I think we've got to tailor our expectations to the mess that the world is in. I know that's not a very optimistic comment, but I think we need to be realistic, and perhaps this is why. I mean, I certainly don't want to bang on about the use of the civil law, but this is if you've got a company that's been ripped off, if you've got a corrupt official, then there are mechanisms which you can use which are not so dependent on the goodwill of governments and political decisions.
I just wanted to make one comment, which is, while many things have to be done at the state-to-state level, so much can be done at the personal level. And there's no substitute for developing across the border personal relationships. And that's, I mean, I've been doing this now for almost 40 years. You can tell, like, my hair has changed color since when I first started. But the most effective things that we've done in terms of assisting each other in developing new legislation or learning new techniques or going after or finding different ways of seizing assets have been more often than not because of personal relationships we've developed. And, you know, sometimes I learn more over the drinks at the bar than I do in seminars, but I go to the seminars to make sure I am invited to the bar so that I can... And all the takeaways that come from that. So no matter what's going on at the 30,000 foot level among, you know, warring parties and warring with a small W, I hope, we working together personally, I think, is something we can always rely on to make some progress.
Right, so I worked on the very first civil forfeiture law in Ontario, and Steph was one of my mentors. And if you listened really closely to the American panel, you might have found some things that have worked their way into Canadian law, and that's because of Steph. I still remember meeting him in his office on New York Avenue in Washington 25 years ago. So I would agree with you on relationships. There are some things that are hopeful, right? There's CARIN, the Camden Asset Recovery Information Network, there's EGMA. So there are some modalities, and we're in a weird place in Canada, right? So you've got a prime minister that's recognizing that maybe if the Americans are going to try and monetize their hegemony, then maybe we look to Europe and Australia and Asia. And so whatever we're going to do, we're in this weird point of flex. But I actually think that might be a really good thing.
Any other thoughts, questions? Going once, going twice. So thank you. Thanks, panel. Just a couple of comments, if I may. One negative, and then I'll get on to the positive, because we have to finish on a positive note. And of course, Kim Campbell is always positive. So you can be guaranteed we're going to leave on a high note. But we actually extended an invitation to all the civil forfeiture provinces across the country and the territories, those that have and those few that don't have civil forfeiture, and most of them couldn't get travel approval to even come here. So that really says something about, you know, the state of affairs. So when we say civil forfeiture or forfeiture at a crossroads, it truly is. But that's the negative. On the positive, you know, I think we, There are a lot of things that we can be grateful for, not only the quality of the people that you saw on the panels and the quality of people that are doing the work behind the scenes and so forth, but the power of individuals. The fact that Steph Cassell has been in this field for 40 some years and he's already been outplayed by his daughter, and he's admitted it openly, we'll now be calling him Taco from now on, right, you know? I mean, I was driving up Highway 99, and there was something going on in the States, because there's something going on every day in the States, and I flipped to CNBC, and then I'm thinking, that's a very familiar voice. Like, who would I know at CNBC? Megan Casella, of course, right? Which leads me to another theme, and that is, we're a bit of a broken record on this, but Megan actually was a volunteer at the Secretariat at Cambridge, along with my daughter and others. So everybody, it's very collegial, this world. And, you know, kudos to, again, Barry Ryder, 42 years running this symposium. If there's any opportunity to get there, this discussion that we've had today, the 2 days, will continue in September, first week of September, for over 5 or 6 days, and be populated by speakers from around the world. It's really quite fascinating. So I highly recommend it to anybody. But my final note, and not only was Barry Butler amazing in terms of presenting the model in Ireland, but look, Bill Browder, there is the power of one person. So admittedly, he's a billionaire. He's made his money, but he's also taken on a cause for the rest of his life. And that is the death of his lawyer, Mr. Magnitsky. And he's relentless. He has not stopped. And this is one person who's been able to walk into the quarters of power around the world, make legislation happen in the biggest countries, the powerhouses of the economy, of the world economy, and actually make change. So I really think that is a reminder to the rest of us that we can all, in our own way, make change. And I know that the people that you heard from over the last couple of days are all change makers in their own right. So that's what we've got to do.
That was the June 18th wrap-up session at the Vancouver Anti-Corruption Institute's 2025 Conference on Asset Forfeiture. More information about the Institute, go to icclr.org/VACI.
News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In focus, Taiwan.tw. Taiwan's exports hit new high in August, beat forecast on AI boom. Exports of $58.49 billion in August, up 34.1% from a year earlier. The figure beat earlier forecasts of $51 billion to $53.2 billion. The August result also marked the 22nd consecutive month of year-on-year export growth. The United States remained the largest buyer of Taiwan-made goods in August, with imports hitting a record $19.63 billion, up 65.2%. Meanwhile, four of Taiwan's smaller political parties, the New Power Party, the Taiwan State Building Party, the Taiwan Obasang Political Equality Party, and the Green Party Taiwan, announced they would join forces in the 2026 local elections. In ABC News Australia, hopes Australia's first treaty with Aboriginal people will help close the gap. Indigenous leaders across the country have welcomed Victoria becoming the first Australian parliament to introduce treaty legislation. The legislation enshrines a democratically elected body for First Peoples that will be consulted on laws and policies affecting Indigenous communities. There are calls for other states and territories to use the Victorian example as a model to establish their own treaties. In Kyoto News, Japan, Philippines agree to enhance defense cooperation with eye on China. The Philippines has procured air surveillance radar systems from Japan in a bid to boost its defense capabilities in the face of China's activities in the South China Sea. Manila and Beijing have clashed over their overlapping claims in the area. Japan, for its part, has seen Chinese vessels repeatedly entering its waters around the China-claimed Senkaku Islands in the East China Sea. Defense ministers also affirmed the importance of multinational defense cooperation with the United States, Australia, South Korea, and other nations. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In Willamette Week, governance consultant that sought to help city council drops out of procurement process. HRNA advisors decided not to continue as one of the two finalists in the city's procurement process. The 12-member Portland City Council grappled with a vacuum of rules, policies, and procedures in the new form of government that the city adopted at the beginning of the year, following voter approval of a 2022 charter reform measure, and as tensions between councillors flared. In Crosscut, another state budget casualty, school field trips to the Capitol. The campus will lose almost half its part-time guides, even though nearly 2,200 Washington students were on the waitlist for tours last school year. In the 2024-2025 academic year, more than 15,000 students in grades 4 through 12 made their way through the halls of the Capitol on a civics tour offered by the state. But starting this year, the number of students who take part in this educational opportunity will fall significantly due to state budget cuts. And check out thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com for the stories behind these headlines. BC man who promotes China to Canadian politicians seen at Xi Jinping's military parade. And the podcast, Terry Fox's Legacy 45 Years Later. Read the stories behind the headlines. Go to thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate, so you won't stand alone, you won't stand alone. The Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting. Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to coaches, the people in sport who help athletes, individually and teams, reach their potential, or greater. It's Coaches Week in British Columbia from September 15th to 21st. And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to Bob at thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of September 14th, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 14th of September in 1994, a strike canceled the rest of the Major League Baseball season? The Montreal Expos had the best record at 74-40. Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to Bob at thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news, and you can also find us at thebreaker.ca. And introducing bobmackin.substack.com. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. Or follow The Breaker News for news as it happens on X, formerly Twitter. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $7 a month. For more information, go to bobmackin.substack.com. Until next week.